Well, it's good to be together this morning. Good for me to be back after being out a couple of things this week. I want to thank Barry for getting you through the last couple of lessons so adeptly. Really appreciate the job that he did. And we are going to be picking up in Exodus 32 today. That's lesson number 9. If you happen to need a copy of what we're working our way through today, just hold your hand up and we'll be sure to get you that. What we're studying this quarter are the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, with a special focus on foreshadowings of the gospel. So we're going to be looking at a lot of New Testament connections as we go through. Of course, we've already been doing that. And we are at the point in the narrative where Israel is at Mount Sinai. Of course, Barry took you through the giving of the law. At least the initial parts of that, the sights and sounds at the mountain and all those kinds of things. And we're kind of continuing that today. Of course, a lot of what we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks in terms of the content of the law itself are things that are given at that time. So let's just dive right in. Exodus chapter 32. What's Moses doing when we open up Exodus chapter 32? All right, he's up on the mountain. We're going to do a couple of things in these next couple of lessons that are that don't strictly follow the order of the text. We have skipped over the instructions regarding the tabernacle because we're going to combine those with the actual carrying out of those instructions. That's going to be our lessons this coming Wednesday and next Sunday. We're going to look at the priesthood, the ordinances of the tabernacle, and all those kinds of things. So we kind of skipped over that, but we pick up and Moses is on the mountain, and well, how long is he there?
40 days.
All right, he's there for 40 days. He's there long enough that the people decide, oh, Moses isn't coming back. Or he's delayed a really long time, we're not sure what's happened. And so Exodus 32 is yet another of a lot of things in this entire narrative that we look at and think there's no way that should happen. We've already seen several. We've seen the complaints of the people when there didn't appear to be any fresh water to drink, or when they didn't think, you know, when their food supply ran out, oh goodness, what are we going to do? Moses, why have you brought us out into the wilderness to kill us all with hunger or with thirst? And of course, God has answered every one of those needs and taken care of them. And here they are at the place where God has appeared to them, has spoken to them, such that when they heard those things, that remember they said, Moses, you go and talk to God, because if we keep listening to this, we're just all going to die. And yet, at some point, a few days go by, a few weeks go by, Moses hasn't come down yet, and the people get bored. The people get distracted. And so they come to Aaron, who evidently has been kind of left in charge of things while Moses is there. And of course, Aaron's been a spokesman along with Moses in Egypt. He's a figure that they that is widely recognized. And what is their request of Aaron? Okay. They said, make us a God who will go before us. Anybody got that in the plural in your translation? Make us gods who will go before us? Okay. It's because we're dealing with the Hebrew word Elohim, which is the generic word for God. But even when it is applied to the true God, it is in the plural. It's just one of those words that kind of works like that. It's a number of times when we encounter it in the Old Testament, it could be translated a God, or it could be translated in the plural gods. Most of the time when it's used, it's obviously a reference to Jehovah, so it's just translated God. But what are they asking Aaron to do? They're asking him to, now, let's just back up a little bit. Are they asking him to do something that God hasn't spoken about, given them any instruction about? This is, you know, so they can assume this is okay. Okay. All right. Say that again, Lamar. Okay. The first two fundamental commandments in Exodus chapter 20, the first two words of the Great Ten: don't have any other gods before me. Don't make for yourself any graven images. And I think we may talk about this a little bit. That included graven images that were meant to represent the true God. All of that was out. And already, here just days later, they're asking Aaron, make us a god. Now, can Aaron literally craft a god? A supernatural being? Well, of course he can't do that. They're asking him to make some kind of representation that will go before them, because, at least in their thinking, I don't think this means the entirety of the people, but a substantial number of them, in their thinking, Moses just kind of abandoned them. Or maybe they're tired of waiting on Moses. The text doesn't go into all their motivations for this, but they ask Aaron, make us a god who will go before us, for as this Moses, we don't know what's become of him. And Aaron has them remove all their gold jewelry. Remember all those things we talked about them plundering the Egyptians of when they left? Okay. Remove all those things, and they bring them to Aaron, and the text describes him melting those things down and fashioning with an engraving tool a golden calf. And what does he say to them? He says, behold your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Or it could be translated, behold your gods. But since we're dealing with one calf, that's probably, in the people's request and Aaron's words, probably meant to be understood in the singular. Behold your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he built an altar and proclaimed the next day. This is significant. He proclaimed the next day a feast to who?
The Lord.
The Lord. And he specifically uses the covenant name of God in this. What that suggests is that, at least in Aaron's mind, this is meant to be a representation of God, of the true God, or at least a substitute for the true God. Maybe that's what's going on in the people's thinking as well. The problem was, in part, God had already specifically spoken about this very thing and said, don't do it. This is really similar to, in fact, put your bookmark there in Exodus 32. 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12, when the kingdom of Israel divides into north and south, you've got Solomon's son Rehoboam ruling in the south, Jeroboam ruling in the north. And remember, chapter 12 of 1 Kings says that Jeroboam starts changing all the religious features of life in Israel, including building two golden calves, one at Dan in the far north, one at Bethel in the far south of his kingdom. And he said to them, verse 28, behold your gods, O Israel. Pretty much the same language that Aaron had used. And it seems like, based on the language of 1 Kings chapter 12, that Jeroboam meant these things to be representations of or substitutes for the true God, or maybe reminders of the presence of the true God, but it was still a violation of very specific things God had directed, and it became the defining sin of the kings of the northern kingdom. Go on through the rest of 1 and 2 Kings or 1 and 2 Chronicles, and they'll highlight that. And it becomes described not just as a sin, but as idolatry. Look at one more passage, and that's one we've already looked at in this study. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul is recounting some of the things that the Israelites had done, some of the failures of the Israelites in the wilderness. Remember, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. He says, let's not imitate their example. Let's not do the things they did, including this in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. And that's a quote from Exodus 32, verse 6. So, again, let's get the picture. Moses is on the mountain communing with God and receiving the contents of the law. And what are the people at the base of the mountain doing? They're indulging in idolatry. Paul calls it idolatry. You know, by pretty much any definition, it's idolatry. Even though Aaron declares it as a feast day to the Lord, that doesn't change the perverted nature of what they're doing. And so, again, verse 6 says they sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to play. Anybody got the Contemporary Standard Bible? I think it's Christian Standard Bible is what it's called. Update of Holman's Christian Standard Bible. I love the way it reads. Early the next morning, they arose, offered burnt offerings, and presented fellowship offerings. The people sat down to eat and drink and got up to party. Because that's what this was. There are a couple of translations that attach a sexual connotation to that last expression. They got up to play and interpret that as the kind of thing that might have gone on in a pagan fertility cult. We will see Israel do that later. In no uncertain terms, it will be described in that way. This word probably doesn't necessarily indicate anything sexual, but what it does indicate is revelry and party and probably, you know, singing and dancing and all kinds of things, but they're done in honor of this idol. And it's a word that basically means to play or to trifle. Which, when you think about it, is a pretty good word to describe idolatry in general. It's playing at religion. It's, you know, it's trifling. Whatever is being done, whatever, no matter what significance the people attach to it, it's a joke. And that's what's going on at the base of Sinai while Moses is communing with God and receiving instruction from God. You got any thoughts about that? I mean, like we said earlier, it's one of those things we look at it and say, that shouldn't happen. Go ahead, Barry.
Well, probably that's something that they experienced in Egypt. You know, the Egyptians probably did the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they may have thought. This is how you worship a god.
Sure. I mean, that's a pretty rational conclusion to draw. This is what they were used to. This is what they had grown up seeing in Egypt. And we made the observation that so many preachers have, it didn't take long to get the people out of Egypt, but it took a long time to get Egypt out of the people in terms of the way it had influenced their thinking about things, including this. The fact that it happened so soon after they witnessed all the sights and sounds around Sinai that terrified them so much with God's presence and His speaking and you know, commissioned Moses, as it were, you go up and talk to God for us. While Moses is still receiving all these things, the fact that it happens that quickly just, you know, shows you an indicator of what we're dealing with. It's a reminder that cultural influences, you don't just turn them off like a switch. These people have to be trained to think differently. That doesn't mean they have an excuse, but you know that's just where they are. Shane?
Well, their entire time from the time that they left Egypt, they suffered from short-term memory loss.
Yep.
As you mentioned, every time something would happen, God would provide for them miraculously. And then, you know, it seems like 5 minutes later, they forgot what just happened. You know, God gave us water out of the rock, but we're going to starve to death. So God gave us food.
Yeah. So here's God's evaluation to Moses, starting in verse 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." You just notice something in that language in verse 7. Your people whom you have brought up from Egypt have corrupted themselves. The normal way God would speak is, "My people whom I brought up from Egypt." So there is right away this distancing him of God distancing himself from what is going on there, and a reminder of who's responsible. Verse 8, "They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" And then we want to key in on verses 9 and 10 especially. "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people," or a stiff-necked people is the way, that's literally the term, and some of our translations render it that way. They're stubborn. Verse 10, "Now let me alone that my anger may burn against them and I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation," meaning you, Moses. "I'll wipe them out and I'll start all over with you because they've been unfaithful to me." How does Moses reply to that?
Tell them that wouldn't be a good idea. People around them would know that you brought them out there and destroyed them.
Okay.
Yeah.
From Moses' perspective, that's kind of how he argues that. Okay. "Why does your anger burn against your people, whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, 'With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and destroy them from the face of the earth?'" This is not the only time Moses will speak to God in such ways. The question that I guess that naturally raises for us is, is God really intent on destroying the people and Moses talks him out of it? That's how it's described in the text. It's described as Moses confronts God with this and the Lord changes his mind about it. Okay, all right. Yeah, it is very, you remember, let's go back to that since Shane brought it. It's a good comparison. When God was intent on destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham pleaded with God on behalf of the city, remember, started said, "If you can find 50 righteous people in the city, will you still destroy it?" And God said, I will not destroy it on account of 50. And Abraham keeps working the number down. By the way, why do you think he did that? He knew there weren't that many, right? 10. Finally, we get to 10. "Will you destroy it, or will you preserve it on account of 10 righteous people?" And God said, "I will not destroy it on account of 10. Well, there weren't even 10 righteous people in the city of Sodom. But Abraham interceded with God and to that degree affected God's choice in the matter. That's powerful. And that's what Moses does here. It's not an overriding of God's purposes. Do you think there is also an element in this where God is maybe testing Moses' character? Because if you're Moses, would it really be easy to say, "Yeah, just nuke them all right now, just me and you, Lord, we'll start all over and it'll be all good"?
He'd be testing Moses' pride.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Yeah, Moses is described as the meekest man on earth. And he's not concerned for himself, which he could be. "Oh, I'm going to have a nation that's going to be born after my seed." He's concerned for God being impugned. And he does not want God to take any hits to his reputation or anything. And so he's concerned for God, which is, I think that's the right attitude.
Okay. Yeah. Very, very good, Ashley.
I was going to say it also seems to be a way of building his leadership skills. Is he didn't want to be a leader, but now he's like advocating for the people.
Okay. Yeah, that's very good. That's all very good. Yeah. Somebody else?
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Would God have been going against his promise had he done this? Because Moses is still the seed of Abraham. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he had wiped everybody out and started a new through Moses, would that not still have been in alignment with what he had promised? I'm not sure.
Let's ask that. Let me get a couple of thoughts on that. Here's Mike's question. If God, and I don't want to divert aside to this for too long, but if God were to do that, to destroy the people of Israel and start all over with Moses, would that negate or interfere with the promises he had made up to this point to Abraham and his descendants? Ryan's got an answer, so go ahead.
So Joshua was with Moses, it seems, or at least the way, I don't remember what tribe he's from. Judah, I don't know, would he have destroyed every single person? Mm-hmm. And then there's no tribe of Judah, so that presents the issue. I have always viewed these kind of things as promoting prayer. There are multiple ways God can achieve his purpose, most likely. I don't really know, but I assume there are. And so he has one that he decides he can do, and Moses convinces him to go another way. We do the same thing with prayer when we ask something to happen. Otherwise, if it's always just going to be the way God has predetermined, I don't know why we pray and ask God to do something. In one sense,
yeah.
So I assume that God was not tempted to violate his own promise. So I don't know how that would work if you just came back to Moses with the promises made to the sons of Jacob.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And hopefully everybody heard most of what Ryan said. That's what comes to my mind, is say the promises that Jacob made on his deathbed regarding what his sons would do, what the descendants, the tribes descended from his sons would do. If God were to annihilate the entire family of Israel, it's hard to see how those promises would be fulfilled. Is he necessarily talking about annihilating the entirety of the people? Maybe not. I'll just say this. There's a lot more about this that we wish we knew from God's perspective. What it shows for us, I think Ryan highlighted this, the value of prayer and intercession and the way in which that's done, because Moses makes this intercession without an ounce of concern for himself. This is an intercession made on behalf of a largely undeserving group of people who are even at that very moment violating God's will, and he's begging God to be merciful on them and appealing to that as what's consistent with God's character, right? It does show the value of prayer and intercession. It's a great example of the effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. And Moses does that on this occasion. So in rest of chapter 32, we have a reckoning for the events. This is, again, we said at the outset of this, there's a lot of the events themselves that we're passing over pretty briefly because we're trying to focus on New Testament connections. But this is the occasion when Moses, he smashes the tablets that he has been given. He has them grind up the golden calf and put it in the water and make the people drink it. There's an affliction on the people. All these things happen. What is Aaron's explanation when he is confronted? What are you laughing for? Okay, it is one of the most ridiculous excuses for sin that we see in all of Scripture. He describes what happened, and accurately, until he's, I threw the gold in the fire and out came this calf. Well, we know that's not how it happened. It's a great example of the ridiculous things we will say to try and justify our actions after the fact when we have done wrong. That's a great lesson in itself. But that's,
I think it's a weakness in Aaron's character, though, that
sure
make the gap to start with.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure it does. Right?
I hadn't thought about it. You highlighted it in this word, but it's not like all marriage is wrong. They could have. He said, hey, everybody, I'm in a position of authority.
Yeah.
This is your God. Let's have a feast to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He does. That's, yeah, we do. We focus on the making of the calf, and you know, we forget Aaron is abusing his position of authority over the people and his position of leadership. You know, Ashley talked about developing leadership skills with Moses, and here's Aaron, just trashing his own leadership position. And yeah, the people come to him. Make us gods. He's okay. Well, yeah, I've got a great idea. Is bring me all your gold and silver. And then when he sees their response to it, he declares the feast day. Yeah, all those things. So it just watch this. It is not just the people who have problems during the wilderness sojourn. Their leaders struggle. Aaron struggles. We'll see Miriam struggle. We'll see Moses struggle with their own failures and shortcomings in various ways. Let's go on down, just in the interest of time. I want to go down to chapter 33. Now, this one is easy to miss if you're just reading through the text. Easy to miss what God is proposing here. In chapter 33, verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought from the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying to your descendants, I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way. God says, I'll send my angel before you, and I will give you the land, but I am not going up with you. I mean, is that a distinction without a difference, or is this something significant?
It goes back to what you just said earlier. He seems to be distancing himself.
Okay.
It's kind of second.
All right.
And all this, I'm going to distance myself. Your people.
Okay.
He said to Moses.
All right. Okay. Is he still saying, I'll give you the land? Yeah. I'll drive out your enemies before you, but I won't be there. My angel will go before you. But in some significant sense, God is saying, I'm not going to be there. Barry, go ahead.
Well, you know, God said, if you will obey me, you will be my people. You will be a holy nation unto me. And obviously, he was beginning to see that they're not going to be able to do that. And so he, in some ways, seems to be needing to distance himself. They're obedient sometimes, but sometimes they're not.
Right.
So how do you balance them being his people yet when they're disobedient, he's not their people?
Okay. All right. Very good. Very good. And what we'll see is a lot of the built-in features of the law highlight that very thing, that God is present among them even though they need to know they're not worthy to have him present among them. And there are a number of features in the law that highlight the fact that sin puts us at a distance from God. And we'll see those as we go along. Marcos, go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of equate that to like obtaining physical prosperity, but then having the poor spiritually. So God was going to give physical prosperity, you know, land, so the farmer, but he was not going to be in their midst.
Very good. Very good. So what is Moses' response to that? Because I know for a lot of people in a leadership, that sounds like a deal I'll take. Okay, you're not going to be with us, but we're going to get the land anyway. We're out of Egypt. We're free. We get the land. God keeps his promises. It's all good. We'll take that deal.
God's presence with them was a distinguishing feature between them and the other nations. And if
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what Moses appeals to, is it not? The desire for God's presence among them, not just for God doing things for them. This man at least recognizes that what this is about is not just God, you know, being a vending machine that dispenses gifts to these people just because he promised those things. Moses, we need to have a sustaining relationship with God. If God doesn't go up with us, then what's the point? Yeah. Jane? Yeah.
Well, suddenly the memory came back. It seems like, oh, wait. We don't want to be without God. It's like all of it. It seems funny. And of course, there's a lot of hyperbole in here when it says all the people, because when Moses came down to camp, he said, whoever's on the side of God, come with me. And there were the sons of Levi that, you know, apparently had not partaken in it. Mm-hmm.
Is that not how we sometimes do? You know, we want the gifts and the blessings and all the stuff, but you know, all the stuff, that's probably the right word. But the lordship, the relationship, the obedience, those things we sometimes decide, man, it'd be great if we could have one without the other. And on Moses' part, there's this craving. No, Lord, if you don't go up with us, how do we even know that we found favor in your sight? How do we know that your people, we are your people, if you don't go up with us? The key ingredient would be missing, right?
The Israel, I sometimes I wonder. I mean, they as much grief as we give them, they had to. You know, they didn't have drinking water. They didn't know where their food was coming from, and they, you know, they had what we could call legitimate complaints. We're stuck here in between the sea and the Israel or the Egyptian army. Like they don't know what's going. Where is it? It's been 40 days. Like we can't live that long without food. What's going on here? They have what you could consider legitimate concerns. It's their approach is so different from Moses. Their approach is satisfy me and take care of me. Moses' approach is be pleasing to God and have that relationship. And so the path they take when they complain to God or they whine, and Moses pleads based on God's nature and God's promises. And so that just, you know, he had the same issues. He didn't have any more food than the rest of them did. But that approach makes such a big difference. And I think we do the same thing. We get wanting our own needs satisfied, and I don't consider what God has planned for me, for the people around me that I know, or what God has planned for his glory. And Moses seems to take that approach much more as a part of who he is and how he relates to God than many of us do.
Yeah, very well said. Very good. It's in the context of this intercession with God that Moses says to God, this is down in chapter 33 and verse 18, I pray you, show me your glory. Can you understand Moses at this point feeling like he needs some greater manifestation of God's presence than he has received up to this point? I take what Ryan said to heart. Sometimes we're harder on the Israelites than we should be, because we would have done the same things, at least in many cases. Show me your glory. And this is when God, you know, reminds Moses, no man can see me and live. You cannot see me face to face. You cannot see my glory unfiltered, we might say. And so what God says in essence is that, you know, that I will pass by you and you will witness something. The way God describes it is, you know, I'll pass by and you'll see my back as I pass by, but you can't see my face. I don't think God necessarily means that literally, but Moses is going to see something and still be protected from, you know, from seeing, from witnessing something that is just, you know, that's fatal to mortal man. We connected that with John chapter 1, because what does John say in the opening of his gospel in John 1 in verses 14 through 17? I think there may be an intentional calling to mind of some of these concepts from a passage like Exodus 33 in John's language. Let's just go read it. John chapter 1. John is opened by describing the Christ, God the Son, as the Word. And he says in verse 14, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." By the way, you might get a different expression than "he dwelt among us" in your Bible. Lived among us. Okay, took up residence. What John literally says is he tabernacled among us. He pitched his tent among us. That word that's translated "dwelt" or "took up residence," harkens back to the idea of a tent that you lived in. And, you know, would probably convey the, we're going to be talking pretty soon about the tabernacle where the presence of God was among the people, would probably have conveyed that idea to John's readers. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. He talks about John the Baptist testifying of Him. Verse 17, "For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ." What has John just said in all of that? I'll suggest what he said in essence, that we got the answer to what Moses asked for back there in Exodus chapter 33. "Lord, show me your glory." And now God has done that in a way maybe nobody would have expected. One of the Godhead became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we saw His glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Notice the contrast in verse 17. "The law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ." And John probably means a pretty significant contrast between "given through Moses" on one hand and "realized" or "came through" Jesus Christ on the other. Not just a contrast between Moses and Christ, but a contrast of superior revelation. Because what John describes is not just Jesus coming and, you know, being a lawgiver like Moses. Well, he did that, but he did so much more. That's one of the things John will highlight in his gospel, is Jesus saying, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." You want to see what God's glory looks like? Here it is. Go ahead, Mike.
In 1 John 1:1, which is kind of parallel, mm-hmm. These are the things that we saw, that we heard, that we touched. So, you know, Moses was kind of put in the cleft of the rock and was able to see the back of God. But John is saying, we were able to behold God, touch God, see and hear Him, that much closer connection that establishes our faith and lets us see the glory of God.
Yeah, very, very good. Yes. One more thing we need to talk about before we finish up today, and that's down in, it's described in chapter 33 and also in chapter 34, that Moses, according to chapter 33, would pitch a tent outside the camp, and he referred to it as the tent of meeting. Now, this gets a little confusing because there are some times in the narrative later on when the tent of meeting seems to describe the tabernacle and not this tent that we're talking about here. So sometimes we have to sort that out. But we're describing, you know, evidently before the tabernacle was actually constructed, the tent of meeting. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, the people would stand at the entrances of their own tents until Moses had gone in, and he would commune with God. The pillar of cloud would descend on the tent, and the whole time Moses is in there talking to God, the people were worshiping. And when Moses, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend, verse 11 says. Chapter 34 adds this, that when Moses came down from the mountain, his appearance had been changed. How? All right, his face was shining because he had been in the presence of God. I don't know exactly what that looked like, but it was something obvious. And so much so that it says Moses put a veil over his face while he was among the people, except when he went into the tent of meeting to talk with God. Then he would take the veil off. He would come back out to deliver whatever message he had received from God to the people, and his face would be shining, and he would put the veil back on. Now in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul makes beautiful use of that, and this is important because Paul doesn't talk about Moses the man all that much. He talks about the law a lot. But in 2 Corinthians 3, Paul talks about, and we'll start with this today, and if we need to finish it Wednesday night, we will. But what use of that picture does Paul make in 2 Corinthians 3? It starts around verse 7 and really goes down through the end of the chapter, where Paul talks about the veil over Moses' face, and you know, the people couldn't look at his face because it was shining and all. What use does he make of that imagery? What point does he draw from it? This is one of the longer analogies in Paul's writing, so you gotta take a moment to take a look at it. James? Okay, all right. James said Paul is gonna draw a comparison between the veil over Moses' face and a veil that lies over people's hearts. All right? And what, in general, what is Paul talking about in 2 Corinthians 3? He's taking two things and contrasting them. What are they? The old covenant and the new. Okay. 2 Corinthians 3 is some of the most stark language in the New Testament about the superiority of the new covenant to the old. And Paul does that by talking, in part, about what we just read in Exodus 33 and 34 about Moses wearing a veil over his face. What does Paul call the old ministry? He calls it the ministry of death, verse 7, in letters engraved on stones. He said, that came with glory. All right. Is anybody going to deny that there was glory attached to the coming of the law of Moses? You know, the smoking mountain and the sounds and the things that terrified the people. And Paul highlights, I mean, Moses' face was shiny. You know, so that the sons of Israel couldn't look intently at his face because of the glory of his face. What we just read described in Exodus 33 and 34. He says, if that had glory, how much more glory is attached to, verse 8, the ministry of the Spirit? So he contrasts the old law as the ministry of condemnation, verse 9, with the new that is the ministry of righteousness. One had glory, the other has greater glory. One had a glory that Paul describes as fading, and the other has a glory that's permanent. We'll pick up with that thought Wednesday night, and then we're going to look at, have two lessons really, highlighting God's instructions regarding the building of the tabernacle, what Exodus says about the building of the tabernacle. We're going to talk about some of its features a little bit. We're going to look at the significance of some of those things. Those are things we'll need to bear in mind moving forward as we talk about some of the events and ordinances that are coming up. But we'll begin 2 Corinthians 3. We're going to finish that up Wednesday night and look at what Paul says about Moses' shining face and that veil and what he draws from that in 2 Corinthians 3. All right, thank you for your comments and questions this morning.